Menards Black Friday sale is here. Get everything you need to bring home the holidays. A Nerf Blaster dog toy blasts tennis balls 75 feet. Fun for you and your pup. Just $15.99. Delicious Dubai chocolate is $12.99 a bag. Color-changing squish lamps and Performax drill bit sets are only $4.99 each. Menards has great Black Friday gifts for everyone in your family. Hurry in while supplies last. Good through November 30th. See Menards.com for details.
Here. Oh boy, got some blood going.
Yeah, this blood.
He's wearing it too.
Welcome to the bed. When you get over to the bed, we'll go ahead and give you the story. This is all going to happen super fast. Welcome to the emergency room.
70-year-old female, single driver of a vehicle. Appears that she went off-road into a ditch, rolled over her car onto a trailer, caved in the tunnel. The vehicle was caved in, so she was hanging out parked in the window.
We have 22 in your left hand. 45 minutes of CPR. No, we can stop CPR. Six over.
Welcome back to the Deep Dive. Today, we are taking a really close look at a critical area in acute care. High stakes medical surgical management. And we're focusing specifically on acute thoracic trauma.
Yeah, this is definitely a deep dive. It's tailored for, you know, clinicians, nurses, residents, anyone getting ready for exams or just wanting to sharpen their skills on the floor. Our mission here is really prioritizing those immediate life threats. We're kind of applying that Pareto principle, you know, drilling down into that critical 20% of chest trauma knowledge that really gives you 80% of the understanding you need for patient survival. It's about getting the broadest clinical picture from the most vital info.
And the source material is super clear on this. This field is all about urgency. When you're talking chest trauma, it's the prompt diagnosis and honestly, the simple interventions. A needle, a tube, managing air, managing blood that save lives.
Exactly. Something like less than 10% of blunt chest injuries actually end up needing complex surgery. Most are these, well, mechanical disasters that just need straightforward mechanical fixes, and they need them right now.
So our goal today is to sort out the absolute need-to-know stuff for immediate intervention from the, let's say, nice-to-know details that help with the fuller picture of patient care.
And critically, focusing heavily on the nursing implications throughout. We want to move past just definitions and really understand what you need to be doing, assessing, and watching for with every single injury type.
Okay, so let's set the stage. What's the fundamental physiological problem we're up against when someone suffers significant chest trauma? What's that core deadly cascade?
It really boils down to what we call the deadly triad: hypoxia, hypercarbia, and acidosis. That's the immediate physiological storm hitting almost every severe chest trauma patient. And a hypoxia, lack of oxygen, that's the biggest, most immediate threat. It's what drives the rapid downward spiral.
Tell us a bit more about that hypoxia. Where is it coming from in these injuries?
Well, it's fundamentally about mechanical failure of breathing. It can come from internal damage, like a lung contusion, basically a bruise on the lung tissue or maybe a hematoma. But the really critical, fast-acting causes, those are the sudden, severe shifts in the pressures inside the chest.
You mean like in tension pneumothorax?
Exactly. Tension pneumothorax or a big open pneumothorax, that sucking chest wound, you just lose the ability to exchange gas effectively. Alveoli collapse, ventilation fails, and boom, the patient immediately starts developing metabolic acidosis because the cells aren't getting oxygen.
And then the hypercarbia, the CO2 buildup, that links straight back to not being able to breathe properly, right?
Precisely. Hypercarbia happens because ventilation is inadequate. That leads quickly to respiratory acidosis, and it happens either because of those massive pressure changes we mentioned, or sometimes just because the patient isn't breathing deeply enough, maybe due to intense pain or a decreased level of consciousness.
So the whole initial focus, the primary survey, it's all geared towards fixing that hypoxia first and foremost.
Absolutely. Our sources really hammer this home. Simple things like basic airway control or, you know, chest decompression with a needle, a finger, or a tube. These are often enough to treat those immediate life threats.
Okay, let's jump straight into those high-yield immediate life threats then. The things we have to catch and fix in that primary survey. Let's start with the one that often scares clinicians the most because it kills so incredibly fast. Tension pneumothorax or TPTX.
Yeah.
#2HI2. High-yield immediate life threats. Primary survey focus, #IK, tension pneumothorax.
TPTX.
Okay.
TPTX. The pathophysiology here is Well, it's kind of elegant in how destructive it is. It's essentially a one-way valve air leak. Air gets forced into the pleural space, the space between the lung and the chest wall, with every breath, or critically, with every push from a mechanical ventilator.
And it can't get back out.
Exactly. There's no escape route. So it's not just air in the chest. It's air under rapidly, dangerously increasing pressure.
And what does that pressure do mechanically?
The consequences are catastrophic, really hitting three systems hard. First, obviously, the sheer pressure collapses the lung on that affected side. But second, and arguably worse, it pushes the entire mediastinum.
That's the middle part of the chest with the heart and big vessels.
Right. The heart, the vena cava, the aorta. It shoves all of that over to the opposite side of the chest.
And that shift isn't just anatomy moving around. It causes devastating hemodynamic problems.
Absolutely devastating. That physical displacement kinks and compresses the great veins, the superior and inferior vena cava. So blood just can't get back to the heart effectively.
So the heart can't fill.
Right. The right side of the heart can't fill, so there's nothing or very little for the heart to pump out. And that leads rapidly to the specific type of shock we see in TPTX, obstructive shock. You get this marked drop in cardiac output and sudden severe hypertension. The patient crashes.
That's a critical point. And another really interesting sort of nice-to-know detail from the sources. We often picture TPTX resulting from some huge accident, right? But the most common cause is actually iatrogenic.
Yes, that's often missed. It's frequently caused by mechanical positive pressure ventilation in a patient who happens to have a small, maybe previously unnoticed, tear on the surface of their lung, the visceral pleura.
So that means we have to be incredibly vigilant whenever we put someone on a ventilator, especially after trauma.
That vigilance is absolutely key. As the nurse often managing that ventilator, if you suddenly see the blood pressure plummet, the peak airway pressures on the machine spike way up, and you hear absent breath sounds on one side right after intubation or during ventilation.
You should be thinking TPTX immediately.
Immediately. Ring that alarm bell.
Okay, so since the problem is pure mechanics, it's pressure, the fix isn't really medication, right? It's decompression.
Correct. While the patient's crashing, yes, you're getting large bore IVs in. You're probably pushing crystalloid fluid because, look, every trauma patient might be hypovolemic too and boosting the central venous pressure a tiny bit might by a second. But the absolute priority is the physical fix. Decompression.
So interprofessional management, this needs action now.
Speed is life here. The MD, DO, or a qualified advanced practice clinician needs to perform immediate needle decompression. Our sources recommend inserting a large bore needle, like a 14 gauge at the fifth intercostal space, just slightly anterior to the mid-axillary line.
Okay, the fifth interspace, mid-axillary line. Mm-hmm. Why there specifically? I know older teaching often said second intercostal space.
That's a really important update reflected in current guidelines. Research showed a pretty high failure rate at the second intercostal space, especially in people with more chest wall tissue. The needle just wasn't long enough. The fifth interspace, more laterally, generally has less tissue. It's thought to be safer regarding underlying structures, and it's more reliable for actually reaching the pleural space.
And what if the needle doesn't work or isn't available fast enough? I've heard about finger thoracostomy.
Yes, that's the next step or alternative. Our sources stress, and this is crucial, TPTX is a clinical diagnosis. You do not wait for an x-ray to confirm it. If you suspect it clinically, you treat it. If the needle fails, or maybe if the clinician prefers, finger thoracostomy is the immediate backup.
Which involves a small incision.
Right. A small surgical cut, blunt dissection down to the pleura, and then the clinician literally pops a finger through into the pleural space to release that trapped air instantly. The principle is the same. Get the pressure off in seconds, not minutes.
Got it. So manifestations. In that noisy, chaotic trauma bay, what are the absolute critical cues that should make you scream TPTX?
You're looking for that deadly trio. Hypotension, that obstructive shock, a unilateral absence of breath sounds on the affected side, and the patient showing extreme air hunger or very rapid breathing, tachypnea.
And the tracheal deviation.
That's the classic sign. Deviation away from the injured side, but it's a late sign. You absolutely should not wait to see it. If you see the trachea shifted, that patient is literally moments from death. Treat before you see it.
Okay. Other signs.
You might find a hyper-resonant note if you percuss the chest on that side. It sounds like tapping on a drum because of the trapped air under pressure. And typically you'd expect to see distended neck veins, Jamie D, because the pressure is backing up into the venous system.
But a key caveat there.
Yes, a huge caveat.
Right.
If the patient is also bleeding significantly somewhere else and is severely hypovolemic, their neck veins might actually be flat. So Don't rule out TPTX just because you don't see JVD. Look at the whole picture, the shock, the breath sounds, the resonance.
All right, let's talk nursing implications. What are we assessing, monitoring, and doing?
Okay, assessment and monitoring. Continuous pulse oximetry is vital. It's going to be low. You're constantly monitoring their hemodynamic status, heart rate, blood pressure. You're watching their respiratory effort like a hawk. But the key intervention is immediate recognition and then facilitating that decompression, getting the kit ready, anticipating the need.
And once the decompression happens, say, with the needle, what's next?
Once that needle or finger releases the pressure, you've successfully converted that lethal TPTX into a simple pneumothorax. But the air leak might still be there. So tube thoracostomy, a chest tube, is mandatory immediately afterward. This ensures the air doesn't reaccumulate and helps the lung fully re-expand.
And patient education, if they're conscious.
If they are conscious, it's tough but crucial. You have to quickly explain, we need to release pressure from your chest right now, it's an emergency, and let them know a chest tube will follow. Manage their immediate pain as best you can, but analgesia cannot delay that life-saving decompression for even a second.
Okay, quick review summary for TPTX. High-yield NCLEX-style cues.
Priority, immediate decompression, needle or finger, followed by a chest tube, shock type, obstructive, key assessment cues. Absent breath, sounds on one side, hyper-resonance to percussion, hypotension, #TACTHEADPFIX. Open pneumothorax, second chest wound.
All right, pivoting now to our second immediate life threat, the open pneumothorax. This one's visually pretty dramatic, often called a sucking chest wound. What's the mechanism here?
Yeah, this one involves a large defect in the chest wall itself. The sources specify a hole that's roughly two-thirds the diameter of the trachea or bigger, and importantly, it stays open.
And why is that size threshold significant?
Because it means that during inspiration, the path of least resistance for air isn't down the trachea into the lungs. It's straight through that hole in the chest wall. Air bypasses the lungs.
So the patient tries to breathe in, but air just rushes in and out of the hole instead of going where it needs to go.
Exactly. Atmospheric pressure basically equilibrates with the pressure inside the chest through that defect. This severely screws up effective ventilation. The immediate result is, again, hypoxia and hypercarbia.
So management here seems pretty straightforward conceptually. Close the hole.
It is. While you're doing the standard trauma resuscitation stuff, getting IVs, giving crystalloids, the definitive immediate treatment is a mechanical seal. But it has to be done in a very specific way.
Okay, let's take interprofessional management first. Who does what?
Well, the immediate temporary closure might happen pre-hospital by paramedics, or it's one of the very first things done in the trauma bay. Later on, definitive surgical closure will likely be needed. But the immediate crisis management is about getting that temporary seal on correctly to restore something closer to normal breathing mechanics.
And the nursing role in this immediate phase?
It's crucial. You're often the one grabbing the supplies and actually applying or securing that temporary dressing. And you absolutely have to ensure that later interventions, like putting in a chest tube, are done away from the wound itself through intact skin. This prevents contaminating the wound and maintains the integrity of that temporary seal.
Manifestations. What does this look like besides the obvious hole?
Well, the patient will clearly be in pain, having trouble breathing, likely breathing fast, dyspnea. But the absolute hallmark sign, the giveaway, is the sound. You can literally hear the noisy movement of air through that chest wall injury. It makes a sucking or gurgling sound with respirations.
If you hear that, you know exactly what needs to happen next.
Precisely. There's no ambiguity there.
Okay. Let's drill down into the nursing management, because this is where that critical action comes in, with that one simple procedure that has a potentially lethal pitfall.
Right. The immediate intervention is to promptly cover that defect with a sterile occlusive dressing. You want something large enough to generously overlap the wound edges. In the heat of the moment, this could be anything impermeable plastic wrap from a kit, the side of a sterile water bag, specialized petrolatum gauze. But the absolute non-negotiable rule is how you tape it.
Okay, here it comes.
You must tape the dressing securely on only three sides. Leave one side untaped.
Only three sides. Explain why that's so critical. What does the flutter valve effect do?
Taping just three sides creates a makeshift one-way valve. When the patient inhales, the negative pressure generated inside the chest sucks that untaped edge of the dressing down flat against the skin, sealing the hole and preventing outside air from getting sucked into the pleural space.
Okay, blocks air going in.
Right. Then, when the patient exhales, or especially if they cough or strain, the pressure inside the chest becomes positive. This pushes that untaped flap open, allowing any air that did accumulate in the pleural space to escape out. It prevents pressure buildup.
And the deadly pitfall. The thing you absolutely must not do.
Do not tape all four sides. If you tape it down completely, you've sealed the hole, yes, but you've also trapped any air leaking from the injured lung inside the chest with no way out. You've instantly created a tension pneumothorax, which we just established is rapidly fatal. This is probably one of the single highest yield what not to do points in this entire review. One untaped side is life-saving. Four taped sides can be lethal.
Crystal clear. So once you've got that three-sided flutter valve dressing on, what's the next step?
The next step is definitive drainage. As soon as possible, a formal chest tube needs to be inserted, again, through intact skin, remote from the actual wound, to make sure all the air is evacuated and the lung fully re-expands.
Got it. Okay, quick review summary for open pneumothorax.
Priority intervention. Apply a sterile occlusive dressing secured on three sides only to create a flutter valve effect. Danger. Taping all four sides risks causing a TPTX. Key assessment cue. Hearing noisy movement of air through the chest wall defect. #TechTadTaxi. Massive hemothorax.
Okay, our third immediate life threat shifts focus from air to blood. Massive hemothorax. What's the definition here? How much blood are we talking about?
We're talking about a rapid, large accumulation of blood in the chest cavity. The specific definition is usually an initial loss of more than 1,500 milliliters of blood, or losing one-third or more of the patient's total estimated blood volume into the chest space.
And the immediate consequence of losing that much blood so fast?
It's straightforward and severe. The patient is in profound hypovolemic shock. That massive blood loss is the primary overwhelming life threat. Yes, the blood also compresses the lung and interferes with gas exchange, but the shock from volume loss is what will kill them first.
So it's a race. You need to replace the lost volume and drain the blood out simultaneously. Let's talk fluids and meds. What's the priority?
Priority one is massive volume resuscitation. You need at least two large caliber IV lines immediately, think 14 or 16 gauge peripherals, or potentially central access or even intraosseous IO lines if needed. You start infusing crystalloid like saline or LR just to keep the pipes open and support pressure initially.
But crystalloid isn't enough here.
Not even close. The absolute key is blood products now. You have to begin transfusion of uncross-matched, O negative usually, or type-specific blood immediately. You cannot wait for a full type and cross-match. The patient will bleed out before it comes back. This means activating your hospital's massive transfusion protocol right away.
I see a note in the sources about auto-transfusion. That sounds like a useful tool in this specific situation.
It can be, yeah. It's a practical, nice-to-know point. Blood that's actively draining from the chest tube can, under certain conditions, basically, as long as it's not contaminated by bowel contents, if there's also an abdominal injury, be collected using specialized devices.
And given right back to the patient.
Exactly. Collected, filtered, and immediately reinfused. It helps conserve the blood bank supply, gets perfectly matched blood back into the patient quickly, and replaces clotting factors, too. The nursing team plays a big role in setting up and managing that auto-transfusion system if it's used.
Okay, interprofessional management. When do the surgeons absolutely need to take the patient to the operating room for a thoracotomy?
Emergent surgical consultation is needed the second you suspect massive hemothorax. And there are very specific, hard criteria for when that patient needs an urgent thoracotomy opening the chest surgically. These are definite need-to-know points.
Where are they?
Okay, the patient needs the OR if. Number one, you get an immediate return of 1,500 milliliter or more of blood right when you insert the chest tube. Or number two, if there's continuing significant blood loss, usually defined as more than 200 milliliters per hour for 2 to 4 consecutive hours. Or number three, if the patient just requires persistent, ongoing, massive blood transfusions simply to maintain any semblance of hemodynamic stability.
And tracking that output is critical.
Absolutely critical. The nursing role here involves meticulous, frequent monitoring and documentation of that chest tube output volume. You're the one telling the team, we got 1,600 out initially, or they've put out 250 milliliters this past hour. That data directly drives the decision for surgery.
As set to manifestations, how does this look different from the air leaks we just discussed?
The dominant picture is shock and severe hypotension due to volume loss. Similar to TPTX, you'll likely hear absent breath sounds on the affected side because the lung is compressed by all that blood. But the key physical exam difference is percussion.
Instead of hyperresonant.
Exactly. Blood is fluid, it's dense, so you will hear dullness to percussion over the affected side. Think tapping on something solid or fluid-filled, not a drum. And because it's primarily volume loss, the neck veins are usually flat, maybe even collapsed, due to the severe hypovolemia.
Okay, that's the crucial differentiator on exam. Hyperresonance means air, likely TPTX. Dullness means fluid, probably blood, massive hemothorax.
That's a lifesaver distinction right there.
So nursing management priorities.
It's intense monitoring of vital signs, looking for any sign of ongoing shock changes in mental status, falling urine output, poor peripheral perfusion. The main intervention is that rapid volume resuscitation we talked about, crystalloids, immediately followed by massive transfusion protocol activation. And crucially, inserting a single large bore chest tube. The sources recommend a 28 to 32 French size, usually at that fifth intercostal space, mid-axillary line again.
And the purpose of that tube is twofold, right?
Correct. One, to actually evacuate the blood and allow the lung to re-expand. And two, maybe even more critically in the initial phase, to accurately monitor the volume and rate of ongoing bleeding to determine if those criteria for urgent thoracotomy are being met.
Got it. Quick review summary for massive hemothorax.
Priority. Restore blood volume. Massive transfusion simultaneously with chest decompression via a large chest tube, shock type. Hypovolemic, key assessment cue, dullness to percussion on the EFTIT side, hashtag tag 3. Potentially lethal injuries, secondary survey focus.
Okay, so we've covered those immediate primary survey mechanical disasters, TPTX, open pneumo, massive hemo. Now let's shift gears. We're moving into injuries that are still potentially lethal, but might take a little longer to declare themselves, often found during the secondary survey. Let's talk about flail chest and pulmonary contusion. Hashtag tag tag A, flail chest and pulmonary contusion.
Right. So flail chest is fundamentally a problem of structural integrity of the chest wall. It's defined as having two or more adjacent ribs that are fractured in two or more separate places.
So you basically have a segment of the chest wall that's detached from the rest of the rib cage.
Exactly. It's lost its bony continuity. And because it's detached, it moves paradoxically with breathing. When the patient inhales and the chest normally expands, that flail segment gets sucked inward. When they exhale, it pushes outward.
That paradoxical motion must really mess with breathing efficiency.
It does. It impairs the mechanics of ventilation, makes it harder to generate negative pressure, and increases the work of breathing. But often, the bigger problem isn't just the flail segment itself, it's the injury underneath it.
Which brings us to pulmonary contusion.
Right. Pulmonary contusion is essentially a bruise on the lung tissue itself, located under the area of impact or the flail segment. And our sources highlight this as the most common, potentially lethal chest injury in adults.
More common than the flail chest itself.
Yes, because the contusion, the lung bruise, directly affects gas exchange. The injured lung tissue leaks fluid and blood into the alveoli and the interstitial space. This disrupts that critical alveolar capillary membrane where oxygen and CO2 are supposed to swap places. The result is hypoxia, and it often gets worse over time.
And there's a specific point about kids here, too, right?
Yeah, a small but important detail. Children have much more flexible, compliant chest walls than adults, so they can suffer very severe pulmonary contusions even without having any overlying rib fractures. You can't rely on seeing broken ribs on x-ray to rule out a bad lung bruise in a child. You have to suspect it based on the mechanism and their respiratory status.
Okay, so we have this structural problem, flail, often combined with this physiological problem, contusion. What are the main therapeutic goals? It sounds complex.
It is. The goals are primarily focused on two things. Number one, excellent pain control. And number two, very careful fluid management to avoid making the contusion worse.
Let's tackle pain control first. Why is it so critical here?
Because if the patient is in agony from those rib fractures, they simply won't breathe effectively. They'll take shallow breaths, they won't cough, they'll splint their chest wall. This leads straight to atelectasis, collapsed lung segments, and pneumonia. So aggressive pain management is key to allowing adequate ventilation and lung expansion.
What kind of pain management works best?
While systemic IV narcotics like morphine or fentanyl are often used initially, the sources strongly recommend regional anesthesia as the preferred method if possible. We're talking about things like intercostal nerve blocks, injecting anesthetic around the nerves supplying the fractured ribs, or placing an epidural catheter for continuous anesthesia.
Why is regional better than just giving IV pain meds?
This is a really key point. Systemic opioids, especially in high doses needed for severe rib fracture pain, inevitably cause some degree of respiratory depression. They slow down the breathing rate and reduce the drive to breathe.
Which is the last thing you want in someone whose lungs are already bruised and struggling.
Exactly. Giving high-dose systemic opioids to a patient with a significant pulmonary contusion can actually tip them over into respiratory failure and necessitate intubation and mechanical ventilation. Regional anesthesia, on the other hand, provides excellent targeted pain relief right at the site of injury, without causing that systemic respiratory depression. It allows the patient to be comfortable enough to breathe deeply, use an incentive spirometer, and cough effectively, which might prevent the need for intubation altogether.
So, facilitating those blocks, managing epidurals, that's a big nursing role.
Huge. Understanding how they work, monitoring their effectiveness, managing the infusion pumps, assessing for side effects, it's all critical nursing care.
Okay, now the second goal, careful fluid management. Why the caution? Trauma patients usually get lots of fluid, right?
They do initially, especially if they're in shock. But once the patient is stabilized, particularly with a known or suspected pulmonary contusion, you have to practice cautious fluid resuscitation. You need to avoid volume overload at all costs.
Because extra fluid makes the bruised lung wetter.
Precisely. That bruised lung tissue is already leaky. If you flood the patient with excessive IV fluids, you increase the hydrostatic pressure in the capillaries. This drives even more fluid out of the blood vessels and into the lung tissue, worsening the edema, worsening the contusion, impairing gas exchange further, and potentially accelerating the progression to full-blown acute respiratory distress syndrome, ARDS.
So it's a real balancing act.
It's a very fine balancing act. Yeah. You need enough fluid for organ perfusion, but not so much that you drown the lungs. This requires meticulous monitoring of intake and output, daily weights, and assessing for signs of fluid overload by the nursing staff.
Interprofessionally, who else is key here? Respiratory therapy seems vital.
Absolutely. Respiratory therapists are crucial. They manage supplemental oxygen delivery, ensuring it's humidified to keep secretions loose. They perform respiratory assessments, help with secretion clearance techniques like chest physiotherapy, if appropriate and tolerated, and they are essential in managing mechanical ventilation if the patient does develop respiratory failure.
Is there a specific threshold where we'd say, okay, this patient needs to be intubated?
Yeah, the clinical indicators for intubation in this setting are usually based on gas exchange and work of breathing. If the patient's arterial oxygen level, PaO2, drops below 60 millimeter Hg, despite supplemental oxygen, or if their oxygen saturation, SaO2, stays below 90% on room air or requires very high FiO2, that's a major red flag. Also, just watching the patient if their work of breathing is visibly increasing, they're using accessory muscles, getting fatigued, becoming confused or agitated due to hypoxia, those are signs that respiratory failure is imminent or present and intubation is likely needed.
Okay, manifestations. What do we actually see or find on assessment?
For the flail chest itself, the classic sign is that paradoxical chest wall motion we described, the segment moving in when it should move out, and vice versa. However, and this is important, that paradoxical motion might be really subtle or even absent initially.
Why is that?
Because the patient might be splinting so severely due to pain, or the underlying contusion might make the lung so stiff that the paradoxical movement isn't obvious until maybe they get tired or receive effective pain relief. So you can't rely solely on seeing it. You really need to palpate the chest wall gently. You might feel crepitus, that crackling sensation under the skin from air or bone fragments, or actually feel the abnormal movement or instability of the fractured segment.
And for the pulmonary contusion, what are the signs there?
The biggest danger with contusion is that it often causes delayed respiratory failure. It doesn't always happen right away. The bruising and swelling in the lung tissue tend to worsen over the first 12 to 72 hours after injury as inflammation peaks. So the patient might look okay initially, but then gradually develop increasing shortness of breath, hypoxia, maybe crackles on auscultation over the bruised area. You'll see restricted chest wall movement because of the pain.
So continuous monitoring is key for contusion.
Absolutely. Careful, continuous monitoring of their respiratory rate, their oxygen saturation via pulse oximetry, their work of breathing. You're looking for those subtle signs of deterioration over time. Is their respiratory rate slowly climbing? Are they starting to use neck muscles to breathe? Is their O2 sat trending downwards? That vigilance, especially in that 12-72-hour window, is critical nursing.
Okay. Nursing implications and management summed up.
Priority one is ensuring adequate oxygenation. This starts with providing supplemental O2 as needed and, crucially, facilitating that aggressive analgesia, preferably regional, to allow for better breathing mechanics. Continuous monitoring of respiratory status is non-negotiable.
And interventions to avoid.
Yes, a definite what not to do. Taping the chest, using rib belts, or applying external splints or binders are strictly contraindicated. These were actually done in the past, but we now know they just restrict chest wall expansion, prevent deep breathing and coughing, and significantly increase the risk of atelectasis and pneumonia. You manage the pain to allow movement. You don't restrict movement.
And patient education.
Vital. You need to teach the patient why pain control is so important, not just for comfort, but for preventing lung complications. You need to actively encourage and coach them on using their incentive spirometer, taking deep breaths and coughing, perhaps while splinting the injured area gently with a pillow for support, to keep their lungs clear. Reassurance about the pain management strategy is also key.
Okay, quick review summary for flail chest and pulmonary contusion.
Primary intervention. Aggressive pain control, regional block preferred if possible, coupled with very careful fluid management. Flail chest key cue. Paradoxical chest wall motion, but maybe subtle, palpate. Big danger. Delayed respiratory failure from the underlying pulmonary contusion, often peaking 12, 72 hours post-injury. Hashtag tag 4. Critical connections and subtle threats. Nice to know.
All right, we've covered the big immediate mechanical failures and the potentially lethal combination of flail chest and contusion. Now let's move into some critical connections and maybe more subtle threats, things that can still kill quickly but might be harder to spot initially or might mimic other conditions. These often fall into the nice to know but clinically vital category. Hashtag TAMIA, cardiac tamponade.
Okay, cardiac tamponade. This is another cause of obstructive shock, like TPTX, but the mechanism is different. Here, the heart itself is being compressed, usually because blood has accumulated rapidly in the pericardial sac, the space around the heart.
So it's fluid pressure on the heart, not air pressure in the chest cavity.
Exactly. And because the pericardium doesn't stretch easily, even a relatively small amount of fluid, say 50 to 100 milliliter accumulating quickly, can dramatically restrict the heart's ability to fill with blood during diastole. Less filling means less blood pumped out, leading to decreased cardiac output and obstructive shock.
Okay, so if both TPTX and tamponade cause obstructive shock, how do we tell them apart quickly at the bedside? This seems like a crucial distinction.
It's a very high-yield distinction to make. The key difference on physical exam lies in the breath sounds. Unlike TPTX, where you have absent breath sounds on one side due to the collapsed lung, in cardiac tamponade, the lungs themselves aren't directly affected by the pressure. So the patient will typically have clear and equal bilateral breath sounds.
Okay, breath sounds are present bilaterally in tamponade. What about percussion?
Percussion over the lung fields will be normal, or maybe dull if there's associated hemothorax, but you won't find that booming hyperresonance that you hear with TPTX. The problem in tamponade is central, right at the heart, not out in the pleural space.
We all learned Beck's triad for tamponade in school. Muffled heart sounds, hypotension, and distended neck veins, JVD. How reliable is that in the real world, especially in trauma?
That's a really important point our sources emphasize. Beck's triad is often absent or incomplete in the trauma setting. Hypotension will likely be there as it's shock, but muffled heart sounds. In a noisy, chaotic trauma bay, they are incredibly difficult, if not impossible, to hear reliably.
And the JVD.
That's the other tricky part. Yes, tamponade causes increased pressure backing up into the venous system, which should cause JVD. But just like we discussed with TPTX, if the trauma patient is also bleeding significantly from other injuries and is hypovolemic,
their neck veins might be flat anyway.
Exactly. Severe hypovolemia can mask the JVD even when tamponade is present. So you can't rely on seeing all three parts of Beck's triad. You need a better tool.
Which brings us to ultrasound, the FAST exam.
Precisely. The focused assessment with sonography for trauma or FAST exam has become indispensable here. A quick ultrasound scan looking specifically at the pericardial space can very rapidly and accurately, sources say 90-95% accuracy, identify pericardial fluid, suggesting tamponade.
And nursing's role with the FAST exam.
It's often about facilitation in that busy environment, helping position the patient if needed, having the ultrasound gel ready, maybe protecting the machine or probe from the surrounding chaos, ensuring the images get documented. It's part of that team effort to get the diagnosis quickly.
Okay, so the FAST exam suggests tamponade. What's the intervention?
This requires definitive, urgent treatment, which is usually surgical. An emergency thoracotomy, opening the chest, or sternotomy, splitting the breastbone, by a surgeon, is needed to directly open the pericardial sac and evacuate the blood, releasing the pressure on the heart.
What if surgery isn't immediately available? Is there anything we can do as a bridge?
there is. While waiting for the surgical team, or transfer, needle pericardiocentesis can be attempted. That's inserting a long needle into the pericardial sac to try and aspirate the blood. It's technically difficult, carries risks, like hitting the heart muscle or coronary arteries, and often only provides temporary relief, but it can be life-saving in extremis. Ultrasound guidance is strongly preferred, if available.
Is there anything else, maybe fluid-wise?
Yes, and this is a key nursing intervention while preparing for definitive treatment. Rapid administration of 5V fluids. It sounds counterintuitive maybe, but giving a fluid bolus can temporarily increase the venous return pressure, CVP. This can help force a little more blood into the compressed heart chambers against that tamponade pressure, momentarily improving cardiac filling and output. It buys precious minutes, #TATCHHEADB, traumatic aortic disruption.
Okay, let's move to another often hidden killer, traumatic aortic disruption. This sounds incredibly serious.
It is. It's actually a common cause of sudden death immediately following severe deceleration injuries, like high-speed car crashes or falls from significant heights. The aorta, the body's main artery, gets partially or fully torn, usually near the ligamentum arteriosum, just distal to the takeoff of the left subclavian artery.
So most people with a full tear die instantly at the scene.
Many do, from massive internal hemorrhage. The ones who survive to reach the hospital typically have what's called a contained rupture. The tear goes through the inner layers, intima and media, but the outer layer, adventitia or surrounding tissues, manage to hold things together temporarily, forming a pseudoaneurysm or contained hematoma. But it's incredibly fragile and can rupture completely at any moment.
So maintaining a very high index of suspicion is crucial. How do we pick this up?
It starts with the mechanism of injury high-energy deceleration. Then you look for clues on imaging, starting with the initial chest x-ray, although CT angiography is the definitive diagnostic tool now. On the chest film, you're looking for suspicious signs like a widened mediastinum, often cited as greater than 8 centimeters wide on a standard portable AP film, though that number is debated, maybe obliteration or blurring of the normally sharp aortic knob, deviation of the trachea or esophagus, if there's an NG tube, to the right, or sometimes a large left-sided hemothorax without obvious rib fractures to explain it.
Are there other associated injuries that should raise suspicion?
Yes, definitely. Seeing fractures of the first or second ribs, or maybe a fractured sternum or scapula, these indicate massive force was applied to the chest and should significantly increase your suspicion for associated great vessel injury, including the aorta.
Okay, so let's say we suspect it based on mechanism and x-ray, maybe while waiting for the CT scan. What are the immediate management goals? It sounds like preventing that contained hematoma from rupturing is priority one.
Absolutely. The entire goal is to decrease the physical stress, the sheer force acting on that injured, weakened aortic wall. This means meticulous, urgent control of both heart rate and blood pressure.
Why both?
Well, high blood pressure obviously increases the tension on the aortic wall, but high heart rate also contributes significantly to what's called DPDT, the rate of pressure rise within the aorta during systole. Faster heart rates mean sharper, more frequent pressure spikes hitting that injured area, increasing the shear stress and the risk of rupture.
So what are the target numbers?
Before starting medications, you want to control pain and anxiety as that helps lower catecholamines. Then the target is usually a heart rate less than 80 beats per minute and keeping the mean arterial pressure, MAP, in a relatively low range, typically 60 to 70 millimeter HG.
Explain MAP quickly for our listeners and why that specific low target.
MAP, or mean arterial pressure, represents the average pressure in the arteries throughout the cardiac cycle. Keeping it in that lower range of 60-70 millimil HG minimizes the constant distending pressure on the weakened aortic wall, reducing the likelihood of rupture while still hopefully providing enough pressure for vital organ perfusion. It's a delicate balance.
What medications do we use to achieve this kind of controlled hypotension and bradycardia?
The typical first-line agent recommended is a short-acting intravenous beta blocker, most commonly esmolol, because it primarily targets heart rate reduction quickly.
And if the blood pressure is still too high after controlling the rate?
Then you might add a vasodilator, often a calcium channel blocker like nicardipine or sometimes sodium nitroprusside, titrated very carefully to bring the MAP down into that target range without letting it drop too low.
What's the big caution here with using these drugs?
The major consideration, especially in a multi-system trauma patient, is hypotension. If the patient is already hypotensive, maybe from bleeding elsewhere, you absolutely cannot give these heart rate and blood pressure lowering medications. You have to address the hypovolemia and control any active hemorrhage first. Trying to lower the pressure in someone who's already in shock would be catastrophic. This requires continuous, invasive arterial blood pressure monitoring and very close nursing vigilance.
And a practical point about transferring these patients.
Yes, the sources emphasize this. If you're at a facility that cannot definitively diagnose with CT angio and surgically repair, usually with endovascular stent grafting or open surgery, a suspected aortic injury, you should not delay transfer to a higher level trauma center just to get more preliminary tests. The risk of that contained rupture becoming a free rupture is too high. Stabilize as best you can with rate and pressure control, if tolerated, and get them transferred urgently. #TagTagTagTagCC. Other important injuries and implications.
Okay, let's wrap up this section with a few other important injuries and connections that often come up in thoracic trauma. Let's start with the simpler air and blood collections. Simple pneumothorax or hemothorax.
Right, so if it's not a tension pneumothorax and not a massive hemothorax, meaning less than 1,500 milliliters of blood initially, we generally categorize it as simple. The standard treatment for both is usually placement of a chest tube again, typically a 28 to 32 French size, inserted at the fifth intercostal space, mid-axillary line, to evacuate the air or blood and allow the lung to re-expand.
Is there a key procedural safety point here, especially regarding pneumothorax?
Yes, a very important need-to-know point. If a patient has any known pneumothorax, even a small one seen on x-ray, they absolutely must have a chest tube inserted before they undergo general anesthesia or receive positive pressure ventilation.
Why is that?
Because positive pressure ventilation forces air into the lungs under pressure. If there's already a hole allowing air into the pleural space, that positive pressure can rapidly pump huge amounts of air through that hole, instantly converting a small, simple pneumothorax into a life-threatening tension pneumothorax. It's a preventable disaster. Always drain a pneumothorax before positive pressure ventilation.
Good point. Now let's revisit rib fractures for a moment.
Right.
We talked about flail chest, but what about the location of other rib fractures? Does that tell us anything?
It tells us a lot, actually. This is a great example of connecting chest trauma to potential injuries elsewhere. Fractures of the lower ribs, specifically ribs 10, 11, and 12, should significantly raise your suspicion for associated intra-abdominal injury, particularly to the liver on the right and the spleen on the left.
Because those organs sit right underneath those lower ribs.
Exactly. Those ribs are their primary bony protection. So if those ribs are broken, you need to be meticulously assessing the abdomen for tenderness, guarding, rigidity, or signs of internal bleeding, like using the FAST exam again. Don't just focus on the chest wound.
And what about fractures of the upper ribs?
Fractures of the upper ribs, ribs 1, 2, and 3, are relatively uncommon because they're quite well protected by the clavicle, scapula, and heavy muscle. Seeing fractures here implies a very significant high-energy force was delivered to the upper thorax.
So you should suspect other major injuries.
Definitely. Patients with first or second rib fractures have a much higher incidence of associated injuries to the major blood vessels branching off the aorta, like the subclavian artery and vein, the brachial plexus nerves running to the arm, tracheal or bronchial injuries, and significant head and neck trauma. These fractures are a red flag for severe, potentially complex associated injuries.
Okay, one last one here. Traumatic diaphragmatic injury, a tear in the diaphragm muscle.
Yeah. This one can be subtle and easily missed initially. It happens when blunt force to the abdomen or chest, or sometimes penetrating trauma, tears the diaphragm muscle separating the chest and abdominal cavities. It's actually more commonly seen on the left side.
Why the left side?
It's thought that the large bulk of the liver on the right side provides some protection to the right hemidiaphragm. The left side is less protected.
How might this show up? What's the clue?
The suspicion should be high if, after placing a nasogastric NG tube, the chest x-ray shows the tube appearing to curl back up into the thoracic cavity instead of going down into the stomach. That's a strong sign that abdominal contents, like the stomach or bowel, have herniated up through a tear in the diaphragm and into the chest.
And that requires surgery.
Yes. Diaphragmatic ruptures require surgical repair. There's also a cautionary nursing note related to chest tube placement here. If you suspect a diaphragmatic injury, especially on the left, you need to be extra careful during chest tube insertion to avoid inadvertently puncturing the stomach or bowel that might have herniated up into the chest cavity. #TagPeaceVV outro.
Wow, that was truly an exhaustive deep dive into the really high stakes world of managing acute thoracic trauma. If we try to synthesize the core learning here, it feels like the primary survey is all about recognizing and performing those immediate mechanical fixes, right? Decompressing air or blood, securing that airway.
Absolutely. It's about fixing the physiology with mechanics first. And your critical assessment skills are absolutely the bridge to making that happen effectively. We really stressed how vital it is to differentiate those key physical findings. Hearing hyperresonance, which screams air, likely TPTX, versus hearing dullness, which points towards fluid or blood, suggesting a massive hemothorax.
That distinction really dictates your next move and understanding the type of shock.
It does. And we also hit hard on the need for that high index of suspicion for the injuries that might sneak up on you, that delayed respiratory failure from a pulmonary contusion that peaks a day or two later, or things like cardiac tamponade, where those classic textbook signs might be totally absent in a real trauma patient.
Yeah, those subtle ones kill because the shock isn't immediately obvious from external bleeding. You have to think deeper.
Indeed. And, you know, we focused heavily on the chest itself today, but it's crucial to remember everything's connected. We closed that last section talking about lower rib fractures as a pretty common injury pattern. So let me leave our listeners with a final provocative thought, pulling directly from the material we covered.
Okay.
If your patient comes in after a trauma with multiple fractures of their lower rib, let's say ribs 10, 11, and 12 are broken based on our discussion, what critical non-thoracic organ system assessment absolutely must be prioritized immediately and why?
That brings it right back around, connecting the test injury to the potential consequences elsewhere.
It does. The immediate priority needs to be a thorough abdominal assessment, including potentially a repeat FAST exam, specifically looking for signs of injury to the liver and/or spleen. Those lower ribs are the shield for those upper abdominal organs. If the shield is broken, you have to assume the structures underneath might be injured too, potentially causing life-threatening internal hemorrhage.
That's a perfect takeaway. In trauma, you always have to treat the whole patient, not just the most obvious hole or break. Thinking comprehensively like that is what truly saves lives. This has been incredibly informative. Thank you for joining us for this high-yield deep dive. We'll see you next time.
My pleasure. Study well, everyone.